Progressive Rugby League.
Hello, John O'Duncan. When I hear the word class, I'm transported back to ninth grade English. I'm reading the part of Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. I'm satisfied with the gravity I'm bringing to the role. And then my voice breaks. And the classroom erupts. But luckily for me, I can suppress that moment for one more hour as we talk not about the school class, and not the Sean Johnson kind of class either, SJ, my DMs are open. No, we're talking class from a societal point of view. Of course, class and rugby league are synonymous. I mean, has there ever been a more clear-cut, more well-defined example of class uprising than the formation of the Northern Union in 1895 that ultimately led to the game of rugby league that we know and love? Not from my blinkered perspective. And because of that history, you can't really go deep on rugby league without discussing class. But in Australia at least, well, perhaps we don't discuss it as much as we should. Well, my next guest has done his bit to corral us back to this most pertinent of rugby league issues by penning an epic and thought-provoking essay entitled The Art of Class War in the latest edition of The Monthly. The essay reflects on how Peter Verlandis has used a working-class ethos to seemingly shake up the Australian corporate sporting landscape. It's also a thorough examination of the diverging class paths of Australia's two premier winter codes, the AFL and NRL. So what does all this mean for rugby league's trajectory in the coming years and decades? After 25 years clawing its way back from the abyss following the Super League War, are we on the cusp of rugby league's moment? Or are rugby league fans just mistaking a change in management style with a change in future fortunes? Well, we've got the author of The Art of Class War, Lek Blain, on the line to give us his view. Lek, kudos on a formidable essay and welcome to the Progressive Rugby League podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That was an epic introduction. I feel like I'm in good company.
No worries. Thanks so much for your time. Lek, when I came across this essay of yours, you know, my girlfriend flopped the latest edition of The Monthly on the dining room table. I flicked through it, and it was one of those moments just like when you hear a great song for the first time and you think, how is it possible this song hasn't been in my life until now? That's the feeling I had upon reading the article. I immediately knew this was the article I'd been waiting for over the last few months. But what drove you to write the piece?
Yeah, in all honesty, that's just been floating around in the sort of orbit of my obsessions since I was quite young, really. And I probably wasn't so aware of the class difference as a kid because sport was just sport. As a teenager, because I guess I just started to mix. My family had really transformed from being from fairly working class stock to being like comfortably middle class by the time that I was sort of in high school. So I was mixing in completely different social networks than what even my brothers maybe did, and definitely what my parents did. And I was coming into contact more with the stigmas that surrounded the cultural activities and cultural obsessions of my youth, the predominant one of which was rugby league. And because I was fairly well educated and people didn't necessarily detect where I'd come from, and so I was fairly camouflaged in that sense, and I was able to sort of get fly on the wall sense of how people sort of thought about rugby league in particular and just working class people in general, because I think that a lot of the time rugby league was just being used as sort of a way to talk about working class people without necessarily using the blunt sort of classist language that might get you in trouble. So yeah, that's a long answer, but I think that as a teenager, I had a lot of conversations where I couldn't really articulate my anger at first. And then as I've sort of developed as a writer and just in general, I think I just become more interested, and I wanted to sort of explore that and see if my fundamental suspicions about that were actually had intellectual grounding or whether I just had a chip on my shoulder about class.
Yeah, it's funny, while class isn't explicitly discussed much, it does hover just beneath the surface in the way rugby league is referred to by the sports and by certain sections of the community. Like you said, it's like having a go at rugby league and rugby league players and rugby league fans is a safe way of having a dig at the working class. I mean, in today's world, you can't get away with saying working class people are bums, and rightly so, of course. You can say rugby league players are bums. In fact, generalising about rugby league players and is quite common, especially when there's issues with player behaviour and stuff. So it's like when something like that happens, it's all bets are off and people have licence to generalise.
And just stuff like references to to tattoos, and which seems so trivial, but it actually does mean something. And it depends on where you are, but like when you're talking about rugby league players, a lot of the time, like, you don't get an NRL contract and part of the NRL contract is to go out and get a bunch of tattoos. Like that's the way that if you spend a lot of time in regional Australia and the outer suburbs of cities, that's how people look at work sites. That's how people look in factories. And I think that there's this disconnect because maybe a lot of middle-class people just aren't coming into contact with those people on a daily basis. And so when they do come into contact with these guys, a lot of whom come back from working-class backgrounds, there's this sort of visceral reaction to it. And I don't think that people are conscious of it. I don't think people are deliberately shitting on working-class people by doing this. It's just that that's probably their closest representation of working class, especially men, obviously, with rugby league players. And yeah, I don't think that it's fully been examined by either the people who are sort of perpetuating that and also by working class people in general, because they're sort of oblivious to it.
Now, we'll get deeper into the class stuff a bit later, but your article sort of centres on Peter Vlandis, and the art of rugby league administration is not unfamiliar to you. You grew up around it. Can you tell us about how rugby league was part of your upbringing in Queensland?
Yeah, I came from a really proud rugby league family. My dad was from Ipswich. His father was a trade unionist and was a blacksmith on the railway in Ipswich. And the Blaine family was really integral in building the Railway Rugby League Club in Ipswich, which later became the North Tigers. And so this is sort of what I touched on in the article, is that there was this really direct link between the trade union movement and rugby league. Like, it's been lost to a certain extent, but yeah, it was a really clear-cut link, and there was a club that was essentially for the people who worked on the railway. And yeah, my dad, he was pulled out of school at 13. He was born in 1949, so that was at a time when working-class kids. He was actually the youngest of 11 kids, and that's the latest any of them started school. All of them dropped out after primary school. He got to go to grade 8, got pulled out, and then went to the meatworks. He was a really keen rugby league player and had older brothers who were exceptional footballers, and he looked like he was going to be like a decent player as well, but he actually suffered a workplace injury at the meatworks at the age of 16, and so he could actually never play football again, which was his absolute obsession. And so pretty much straight away, he spent a long time in hospital, but pretty much as soon as he got back out, he started coaching and started managing, and he's sort of dedicated a lot of his life outside of his family and outside of his work to first, yeah, coaching rugby league. And then later he moved away from Ipswich and moved to various places around country Queensland. But he was a president of the Wandai Wolves up in the South Burnett. And then later we moved to Toowoomba, where he was pretty heavily involved. And he was later on the board of the Toowoomba Rugby League. And he was a sponsor of the Oakey Bears. And yeah, he sort of just had lots of fingers in the pies here, there and everywhere.
And how has your relationship with rugby league evolved over your lifetime? You sort of touched on it in your first answer, but how has it evolved?
Massively. I was completely obsessed with rugby league as a kid because all my brothers, especially one of my brothers, Stephen, was an exceptional player, and I was the youngest of all these athletes. My sisters were really good athletes as well, but I was just always a shithouse athlete. And I sort of, probably not in a dissimilar way to what my dad did, after he lost the ability to play football, he became sort of your stereotypical armchair expert. He was, I think, at North Tigers, and they're actually celebrating the 40th anniversary this year, but he was like a selector, he was like a coach, he was like a manager, he was on the board. And so he was sort of just put all of his obsession towards all the thinking about the game, that side of the game, because he could play it. And that's what I was like as a kid. I just never really had the knack for it. I was never tough enough or quick enough. But yeah, I substituted for that by basically trying to be like a rugby league encyclopedia. And so, yeah, I would literally spend all my weekends and then afternoons after school, either when my dad had a pub, I'd be in the bar and I'd have like a rugby league almanacs, and I'd just be going through and just throwing names at him from whenever. And generally he knew them, and he'd have a story, and he would fill in the artificial stories behind all of these famous players or like completely anonymous players. And yeah, so I really, because of those class differences between me and my dad that I was talking about, I had a quite privileged upbringing compared to him. And he was born in 1949. I was born in 1992. This sport created this rapport between us that just wouldn't have existed. It created these rituals of language and of, yeah, just bonding and just in a way that was outside of ourselves and connected to community. And, you know, like he'd named me after Lech Walesa, who was a really famous trade unionist from Poland, and he was involved with the Labour Party. And,
right.
And I was always super aware that rugby league, it wasn't just a sport, but it actually had, it had like real significance for the lives of my grandfather and for my dad's siblings and for all the similar sort of communities. And yeah, it was really quite a beautiful thing.
Mm. Now, let's get to the article. So in your essay, you make the case that rugby league, with the Super League war firmly behind it and now seemingly united behind Peter Verlandes, is the sleeping giant of Australian sport. Now, I thought that title was permanently reserved for soccer in Australia, but leaving that aside, why do you make that argument?
I think it was partly just an analogy to how China has been sort of interpreted by political pundits for a while, and I sort of saw some just like funny analogies between that and rugby league because of some of those, the class consciousness of the sport. So, yeah, that was probably more about that. I was aware of the way that soccer is talked like that, but I think that when you lay it all out, it's pretty and I think you become so used to the natural state of being that it's easy to forget how things end up the way that they are. And so I think that, especially for AFL fans, and, you know, I definitely don't have any hate for AFL. My sister plays it and loves it, and I think that it's a great sport. But I think that for a lot of AFL fans, especially in the southern states, who haven't had any reason to really do much research into the story of rugby league, they don't probably appreciate the historical anomaly of that. At the exact moment that pay TV money was starting to filter into professional sport, rugby league got hijacked by the Civil War for 3 years.
Mm.
And that for over a decade after that, you had News Limited drawing financial resources from the NRL because of the losses that they sustained during the Super League War.
Mm.
And whether that's right or wrong is sort of irrelevant. It's just that that's how we got to this point. The point of that sort of stuff wasn't that the Super League War had destroyed the popularity of rugby league so much. It was that it destroyed the ability of rugby league administrators to transfer that popularity into structural, financial infrastructure in terms of what we've seen with the AFL, the way that they've been able to expand, the way that they've been able to gain a significant asset base, the way that they've been able to invest in AusKick all over the country, and especially in Queensland and New South Wales. Rugby league just didn't have the financial surplus to do that, and that was because of the Super League War.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a sliding doors moment because it so easily could have gone the other way. But yeah, I think it was more just a play on that, and it was more this idea of what happens when rugby league isn't sort of fighting with one arm behind its back.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Rugby league was hobbled for over a decade after the Super League War. It just wasn't 1 year of war. There was a long aftermath. And I don't know, from my personal experience, when I was a kid, I was probably, 12 or something when it all kicked off. And before that, rugby league was all we spoke about at school. And then 1 year later, literally 1 year later, you were embarrassed to say that you liked rugby league. Things had changed so quickly, and other sports were cool, and rugby league was very much on the nose. So, yeah, it took a long time to get over
that. And that's really interesting. My own personal experience of the Super League War was that I was 5 in 1997, and my family were diehard Broncos fans, and so I didn't really have any concept of what the Super League War, except I thought the Super League was awesome and the Broncos were awesome. And so, especially in country Queensland, there probably wasn't really that residue warfare because everyone was just Broncos fans pretty much, and there wasn't really all the rifts or the social fallout from it. So, yeah, that's really interesting to hear that that's what it was like for you personally.
Yeah, it's great to get the Queensland perspective as well. I mean, a few months ago, I got schooled on Queensland rugby league history by Joe Gorman, who wrote...
great guy. I was talking to him the other day.
Yeah, so I learned a lot from that book. Now, Lech, it seems to me like class is rarely explicitly discussed when it comes to Australian sport. Besides the very superficial league is the working man's game, union is for the leather patch brigade. Do you agree, and why do you think that is, if so?
Yeah, it's definitely not discussed beyond the sort of those surface level stereotypes. And again, like, the point of the article wasn't to say that rugby league is this working class paradise. Especially now, like, the game is, especially at the elite level, is fairly well divorced from its working class roots. And they're certainly not, even if they've come from working class backgrounds, it's just certainly not the same sort of structure as what it was when it started out.
Mm.
And also that most rugby league fans now are middle class.
Mm.
So the weird part about it is that this sport, which is a behemoth in Queensland and New South Wales, it's the most popular sport on television, and in some ways it's the most popular sport on television in the country if you include State of Origin. But it's still tarred with these stigmas that really go back to this previous state of being that most people now don't even remember how they came about, but they've just been perpetuated. Yeah, I guess I just wanted to sort of pick that apart and see how we arrived at those sort of stereotypes, because they didn't just come out of nowhere. Like, they're extremely well embedded in terms of the social history of Australia.
Mm. Yeah, I think you touched on something very insightful there. It's funny, doing this podcast, I've had so much more exposure to the UK game than I ever had before. And it seems to me that in the UK game, they talk about class a lot more. And I wonder if it is because rugby league in the UK has never really been able to shake free of those societal class structures. You know, there's probably a million reasons for that. But either way, the sport in the UK can't really be considered upwardly mobile, while the game in Australia, like you say, has crossed that class divide somewhat. And maybe we don't feel the need to discuss it as much as it hasn't necessarily restricted the game's development.
Yeah, I think that I think class is probably less of a taboo in the United Kingdom, in the respect that both middle class people talking about class, but also working class people are probably more class conscious as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not always a bad thing. But yeah, the thing about rugby league in Australia was that, and that's why Australia is such an anomaly in terms of its popularity, is that it gained widespread support in Australia's biggest city, which is Sydney, and then its third biggest city, which is Brisbane, which had never gained that type of support in London. And so that's essentially what hobbled it. Whereas in Sydney, even though it was hemmed in by those class issues to some extent in terms of getting access to private schools, it was really, really agile in terms of accepting the sponsorship and funding from whoever had money. Like, rugby league has never shied away from capitalism. Like, that's the whole reason that it exists. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that's been a good thing. But yeah, I think that really explains the difference, is that rugby league was able to get widespread appeal because it simply took off in areas that had larger population bases than what it did in the United Kingdom.
Mm. Now, Lek, can you flesh out for us the comparative class trajectories of the AFL and the NRL? I've never really paid much attention to the AFL from a class perspective, but it clearly has cross-class appeal, especially for those in AFL states, and it's incredibly popular there. But you paint a picture in your essay of a sport that seems to be moving towards a more middle-class ethos, and I guess that perception is exacerbated by the entry of Peter Verlandis into the sporting limelight. How do you see that all unfolding?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not an expert on the AFL, and I think that, yeah, it's certainly not that I was trying to equate the AFL with, say, rugby union, because I think rugby union doesn't have that cross-class appeal in Australia, whereas all of the great things about rugby league in terms of being a working-class sport and providing social outlets for working-class people, like, the AFL has that as well in the southern states. And then it also has the power afforded to it by the establishment. And I wasn't really aware that that had tilted to such an extent in terms of the influx of players through the draft. And I just found that super interesting. And that wasn't to say that there's plenty of working class players in the AFL still. I just found it really interesting that these schools, the GPS schools in Melbourne, which traditionally hadn't been the strongest schools as far as I can tell, had invested so much time and resources into attracting the best players, and then it's reached this point now where, yeah, they're like producing 25% of the players going into the draft, and that's like 11 schools in Melbourne. And I just found that super interesting that that's been happening at the same time. Yeah, because it's sort of a bit of a piss take in terms of looking at the differences between Verlandis and Gillon McLachlan, and that's sort of just a bit of theatre in a lot of ways. But I think that there is more to it than that. And certainly if you talk to a lot of people behind the scenes, they tell you that they think that it has a tangible effect on the way that a leader might respond to different issues. If they are emotionally in touch with people who don't have power, that's going to mean that they might be able to respond with slightly more empathy.
Mm. Yeah. And I think talking about the diverging class trajectories, I suppose that's also exacerbated when you consider the proportion of rugby league players who are coming from an Indigenous or Pacific Islander background, which is, I think, over 60% now. So, yeah, it is interesting to sort of compare that to, like I say, 25% coming from 11 of Victoria's private schools. So it's fascinating stuff. Now, like, you spoke to Peter Verlandis for this essay, and I should say your article had some very heavy rugby league hitters in Phil Gould, Professor Megan Davis, friend of the show, Peter Beattie, Roy Masters, John Quayle, and more. It's quite a lineup. Now, what did you learn about Peter Verlandis from your dealings with him, and also about how others spoke of him?
Yeah, it was like I went into writing the essay, and I probably had a little bit of that cultural, like just inbuilt cultural cringe where in some ways I was pretty cynical. I didn't think that it was possible for him. And I don't mean the, even so much the public popularity, that can be quite fleeting, but like, I don't know, this isn't the world that I move in terms of like, I'm not a sports journalist. And so I didn't really know the full sort of scene, but yeah, and that was the main thing that I really tried to push people for. And there's people that I spoke to off the record as well who couldn't be quoted. And just in terms of, I wasn't trying to sum up Peter Volandis from his racing history or anything. I purely wanted to focus on the rugby league stuff. And yeah, I just couldn't believe that there were so many people who, with seemingly diametrically opposed views about different things, who all, even if they had certain misgivings about him, all thought he'd done something which nobody else had been able to do, which was to bring all of these different sides together.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's a pretty short period of time, and a year can be a long time, so it's really going to have to wait and see how it all plays out. But I got the genuine sense that he's an extremely effective administrator, and I know that there was, yeah, it's easy to be cynical if everyone's saying someone is good or someone's a genius or whatever, but yeah, I spoke to people that I really trusted, not just on rugby league but in general, who had really intimate dealings with him, and they were who also went into meeting him in this position with quite a lot of cynicism because they'd been warned about him from other people, and then they dealt with him in person and they found him to be a breath of fresh air. And so I'm sure that if you were on his bad side, that you would have a completely different view, and there's a lot of people on his bad side. So I can only sort of go off the people that I spoke to. And as I said, I tried to get as many diverse people from completely different backgrounds and completely different factions within rugby league, and they all, even if they, as I said, even if they had some misgivings, they all thought he was ultimately the best thing that had happened to rugby league for a while.
And why do you think that is? And why is it that virtually it seems the entire rugby league public has got behind him? I mean, is it that this time in history is tailor-made for his style? It seems there's a societal trend that is suspicious towards the smooth talker, and Peter Volandis is the antithesis of that. Do you think that it's his style that's resonating with people, or do you think that he is that once-in-a-generation administrator that have people drooling over him?
It's all the different things. Like, I think timing, definitely. It's long enough since the Super League war that a lot of these things have played out, so maybe if he had have been there at the beginning of the commission, he would have faced the same teething issues that the other administrators faced. And so, yeah, I think that a lot of these people have just reached the end of their tether, and they were probably ready for someone to show leadership. And I think that he'd just been on his own, basically doing his own apprenticeship for dealing with the absolute shit fight that comes from the politics of rugby league. And so that sort of prepared him for that. And he's extremely pragmatic about maintaining relationships with all the various power brokers in terms of politics, in terms of the media. And then, yeah, that other thing, which is the cult of personality that he sort of formed around himself, which is, I didn't really think too much about that while I was writing the essay, but it's sort of, yeah, it sort of goes to that whole place where we're at in Western societies where we seem to be yearning for authenticity, even if sometimes it can be unpolished. We're sort of sick of, say, we as a social collective, not as me personally, but we seem to be yearning for authenticity. And yeah, I'm sure that there's some people who think that Volandis is exaggerating it, and that's what all leaders do to a certain extent. But there's definitely no doubt that he genuinely identifies still with where he came from, even though he's in a lot of ways moved a long way away from that in terms of financially and socially.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by the whole style thing. But yeah, like you say, really, we can only judge him once we see how the sort of the broadcast revenue rights picture pans out over the next few years. You know, rugby league and other sports have taken a haircut on revenues from COVID-19. We're not 100% sure on the details about how rugby league's haircut compares to the AFL's, but, you know, I suppose two things are clear, and they're clear from your article, and he's got a really good track record of getting his way, and B, he seems to be an insatiable work ethic and what seems like obsessive zeal to beat his opponent. And better than that, I think your article paints him as a much more collaborative leader than what I thought he might be from how the media portrays him. So they're excellent signs, but yeah.
And you talk to different chairmen and stuff, and they're pretty powerful people, so he knows who the lines. So yeah, it's hard to judge. But yeah, the sense that I got was quite different from the public persona. And yeah, I wasn't sitting in meetings or anything, but like even someone like Nick Pappas has got no incentive to bullshit to a journalist from the Monthly. Like that's not usual rugby league territory sort of thing. Like I know that there's lots of different vested interests and people are generally in rugby league are so paranoid and sometimes for good reason, but it does seem like there's some pretty good signs.
Mm. And of course, it's important to remember a fair bit is still totally out of his control. You look at the Brisbane Broncos this year, they're a rabble, which is a bit of a problem because the Broncos are the highest rating team in the NRL and ratings for Broncos games have kind of dive bombed this year. So if that continues for a few years, it makes broadcast negotiations quite difficult. And I suppose on a related topic, something that he does have control over, that expansion of the game is an issue that, you know, could either grow the revenue of the game or otherwise. So people are saying Western Australia might be good with a new parochial market, but it seems that Peter Valances seems a bit cool on that, preferring more to fish where the fishes are. So I don't know. We'll wait and see what happens, I suppose. Now, Lek, Peter Valances has won over News Corporation. Now, is that the key for a rugby league administrator? Because obviously News Corp are big players in the game. They have a certain worldview. And if they don't like you and if you don't fit their kind of preferred archetype, well, often they'll go after you until they get you. And it seems like the Peter Beattie and Todd Greenberg combination, despite, you know, doing a decent job during their time at the NRL, of course it wasn't perfect, it seemed like it got to the point where it felt untenable. You know, Greenberg was maybe too smooth, too woke maybe, didn't seem fair dinkum, and Peter Beattie, well, he's a former Labor Premier. So in the current media climate, do you need News Corp behind you to get any clean air and get anywhere? I mean, Peter Beattie admitted to you in your essay that he didn't have the clout in Sydney that Peter Valances had. I take that he's talking specifically about News Corp and the Daily Telly.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a tough one because you're sort of weighing up your own ethical allegiances and all that sort of thing. But for a sporting administrator, especially for a rugby league administrator, history's shown it. Like, there's no point having someone in the job, A, who doesn't have a good relationship with News Limited, as much as you might have a visceral desire to fight a war with News Limited. It's just like ended in disaster. And like, that's not even just with the Super League war. We saw that happen again with John Grant, and that directly benefited the AFL purely out of spite from Rupert Murdoch chucking them another $40 or $50 million with their TV rights deal. And so, yeah, I honestly, as much as it's fairly morally dubious to sort of look at it that way, like, rugby league needed to be completely pragmatic and go, well, we actually need someone here who not only has a track record of working with News Limited, but in some ways, this is a whole thing in terms of the conflict of interest. Like, because of his race and position, people said that there's a conflict of interest. He won't be able to make decisions because he's tied up with News Limited in terms of the money that they both sort of pump into each other. But that means that he's got hard power. He's got hard power, and the only thing that News Limited respond to, not so much on a macro level, because I don't think that the Murdochs are sitting around really worrying about it that much, but on a micro level, in terms of those journalists at the Daily Telly or wherever, they were always just going to respect Peter Valances more because he's part of that whole world. Like, we had two Queenslanders before that, and for all their best intentions, they just got absolutely smashed. And that was just never going to happen to Valances because he'd just been there for so long in these different positions and because he wields so much power in Sydney. Like, they were just never... I think that he's even sort of said himself that eventually, like, his luck's going to run out, and if any sport's going to chew up Peter Valances, it's going to be rugby league. And so I'm sure that there's going to be times where... And that sort of happened a bit recently in terms of Phil Rothfield's was pretty unhappy with him talking about appointing Phil Gould, and so that's sort of another one of those old flare-ups. But I just can't see it being as bitter as what the public campaigns that were waged against those previous leaders, just because purely because he has so much power within Sydney.
Yeah, I'd also argue that his style, like we were talking before, he has that kind of, I don't know, everyday sort of bloke style that sort of resonates with, you know, those the Daily Telly, I suppose, and that sort of readership. And as we're sort of saying, that trend towards what people perceive as the authentic, and, you know, Peter Valances kind of taps into that. And maybe, like you say, this is rugby league's opportunity. You look at Scott Morrison doing his best to prove he's a rugby league fan. And as an extension to that, you know, the government's obsession with making tradies happy. We all love a tradie, but our government's kind of infatuated. So even when they announced their arts package, it was all about helping tradies. So I guess rugby league may as well take advantage of this time.
I think it's a real tipping point for rugby league and all of the historical weaknesses that it's had in terms of the boardrooms being filled with people who didn't grow up loving the game or who loved the game but couldn't sort of openly support it. That's sort of just been rewrote it a little bit because elections are being won and lost in seats that are rugby league obsessed. And so that's why in New South Wales you have a Liberal government, which is a political party that historically you never would have associated with rugby league. Mm. And, you know, they fought a massive public backlash about the stadiums and so forth, and yet they still got re-elected. Whether that's right or wrong, like morally, economically, whatever, like there's a lot of rugby league fans out there and they're not always well represented within the media. But yeah, I think that that's an opportunity that rugby league can't miss. And I think that what it will do as well is that you're going to see the Labor Party coming back to the party as well. And I know after the 2015 grand final, for example, that after Jonathan Thurston kicked the field goal, that Bill Shorten wanted to find out, okay, how do we... Because there's a fair bit of talk about the Labor Party having lost rugby league heartlands, and he wanted to know, how do we win them back? And people told him, give them a stadium, give Townsville a stadium. And so Labor came out and said they built the Townsville Stadium, and then Malcolm Turnbull had to come out and he had to match them. And so what you ended up with was this brand new rugby league stadium in Townsville. And it's, whether that's right or wrong, I don't know, but like there's certainly other sports, and AFL's a big one, that have historically leveraged their social power to get heaps from the government.
Mm.
And I think that, yeah, rugby league are simply like trying to do the same thing. And
that, yeah, that's a fascinating element of this whole situation, that the rugby league vote is a prize vote. You know, like we say, Scott Morrison kind of jumped ship from rugby union lover to quote-unquote diehard leaguey, go Sharks, when he entered parliament. It kind of reflects what's been happening in Australian politics for the past 30 years. As you say, Labor's traditionally the party of the working class, the rugby league. But over the last 30 years, the working class vote, the rugby league votes, it's kind of up for grabs. So the Labor Party has its issues around identity that they're sort of grappling with between working class traditions and I guess their inner city university educated base. And that's a tricky coalition to balance. And we've seen the Conservatives take advantage of that. And what better way to let the working class know that it's safe to vote for you than by telling them how much you love rugby league?
And this, like, it's so hard to articulate to people from outside who maybe aren't interested in sport or particularly in rugby league or aren't from Queensland or New South Wales, and just like all of these intricacies of class and history, how important it is, because it's received as being so trivial in most places. But the whole rugby league thing from Scott Morrison, the reason why it's so powerful for working class people in those outer suburban and regional seats is because they've spent their whole lives feeling like their main obsession was looked down upon by other people, by people from the city or people from the southern states. And so when you have a political leader who, and whether it's fraudulence or not, like it's just smart politics like that, he's creating this emotional rapport with people who have felt looked down upon for a long time. And that's why it's powerful. And
yeah.
I know when he went to the Sharks game after the coronavirus opened back up, and whether that was right or wrong, whether he should have done that while Victoria was facing this terrible crisis. Like, I think one thing we know about Scott Morrison is that he knows exactly what he's doing.
Mm.
And so rocking up to a Sharks game like that and producing the backlash that it did was, like, again,
exactly what he wanted.
Exactly what he wanted, and sent another one of those little signals that he's sending out to all of those, what he calls the quiet Australians.
Mm.
Here's all these people who don't respect people like us, and obviously whether he's one of the, really one of them is, yeah, a different subject, but I just sort of despair even at some of the stuff on Twitter about him going for the Sharks and all that sort of thing. Like, I can see how that can seem trivial to people, but it just plays right into his hands.
Yeah. And, you know, also playing into his hands, I suppose it must be quite galling for the Labor leader, Anthony Albanese. He's kind of a lifetime South Sydney supporter, born and bred in Marrickville. He's absolutely a rugby league guy, and yet he's somehow being out rugby leagued by Scott Morrison. Anyway.
Just quickly, like, honestly, the whole thing about politicians who are sporting fanatics and faking it or whatever, like, there isn't a politician who's probably been more or put more on the line, like, in a tangible way for their sport of choice than Anthony Albanese. So I think that it must absolutely shit him to tears. It's like ScoMo had basically out elbow because, like, he went away and was just like, okay, this guy's onto something, but he's in the wrong party. I'm going to take everything and just take it up a few notches and then win an election. And so, yeah, that's a really hard place for him to be now, because it's like this guy's just doing like an exaggerated version of himself.
Yeah, that's right. Now, for those who don't know, Leck wrote another essay last year on the 2019 Australian federal election titled How Good is Queensland? And to me, that was the definitive post-mortem of what swung that election. Leck, for me, this Rugby League article has echoes of that piece, as they both cover in their own different ways what happens when people who think they know the lay of the land misunderstand or misjudge or underestimate working people. Did you see similarities writing this piece, or was it just a coincidence, or have I overthought things?
No, it's not a coincidence. Like, I didn't necessarily go into it consciously as a continuation, but yeah, it's definitely part of that whole trying to get progressive people and progressive readers and progressive leaders to understand the mind frame of people that they might not come into contact with all the time, which can only be a good thing for progressive politics. And yeah, that was the driving force behind that essay. Wasn't to provide definitive answers, it was simply to show the way that people thought. And yeah, this was slightly different. It really talked to most of the people that I spoke to had some sort of power and were quite central to the game. But I think that all of the broader stuff around that, about class and the way that people feel disrespected or devalued, yeah, that's all really part of that whole zeitgeist that we're seeing, not just in Queensland, but like right around the world at the moment.
Yeah.
And yeah, as I said, that sport can seem trivial, but I think it's having a really tangible effect on politics through the way that persona obtains power. And so I think that's a really useful thing to help frame what happened at the election, to then, yeah, go one step further and really dig into the rugby league, which I think I mentioned in the Queensland essay. But yeah, this is sort of, I guess, the Queensland essay, but about rugby league.
It's absolutely fascinating stuff. Now, Leck, we're out of time, unfortunately, but it's been absolutely fantastic to talk to you and flesh out some of the issues that you raised in your essay. Well played once again on an extremely interesting and timely piece, and we look forward to reading your next. Leck Blain, thanks for taking the time on the Progressive Rugby League podcast.
No worries. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Progressive Rugby League.
Fabulous stuff. And for those interested, Leck will be publishing his first book, Car Crash, a Memoir, in April 2021. So keep an eye out for that. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for your continued kindness. You know how to make a guy blush. Until we next meet, Rugby League, hold me close and see you later. I should probably do that properly. Rugby League, hold me and see ya.